dementia impairs a person's abilities in work, in their social interactions, and in their relationships. One way to address the social challenges is to create a gathering place for people with memory loss and cognitive impairments. We're talking about memory cafes opening up around the country and here in Wisconsin. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Have you been to a memory cafe? Perhaps you've taken an aging parent or relative to one. And if so, what was the experience like, both for the person you took and for yourself? Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Becky DeBurr is Program Director and Outreach Specialist for the Alzheimer's and Dementia Alliance of Wisconsin. That's a nonprofit support and advocacy organization with offices around the state. Becky, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, take us to a memory cafe. What exactly is it?
Well, a memory cafe offers people with dementia and their care partners the opportunity to enjoy just regular social interaction with others who are in a similar circumstance as they are. It's often a very warm and welcoming environment where there's socialization, some beverages and snacks, and cognitively stimulating activities.
What might be these cognitively stimulating activities?
Well, some examples at the Alzheimer's and Dementia Alliance that we've participated in with persons with early memory loss are things like storytelling, reviewing photos from reminiscing of past times, maybe special occasions. I could remember our very first memory cafe in 2012 in Sauk City, Wisconsin, where a tamed hawk was the center of attention, and those who were interested were allowed to let the hawk sit on their arm. And I just remember the one spouse, she was so excited because it was the most she had heard her husband speak in quite some time. So it was very interactive and very touching. So it could be all sorts of things, but it's really participant-driven. They tell us what their interests are, and we help make that happen.
These activities could jog memories or perhaps spur something in their own mind that they can recall.
Correct. Oftentimes with memory loss, we just need to help our loved ones connect to those memories. If you think about it, you know the most about your spouse or significant other, and so we can help connect to maybe the very first car they had when they turned 16, or what was your first pet's name. Oftentimes we hold that information within us as a care partner, and so it's just really helping them connect to those memories through reminiscing and giving them cues along the way to help those conversations really flourish.
Becky, do we know where memory cafes, the idea came from, where they originated?
We do. Actually, they started in Europe. So in 1998, a Dutch psychologist, Dr. Meeson, started a social program for people with dementia in the Netherlands. And he called it an Alzheimer's cafe. And really, the premise for him was because he recognized that his patients was just the importance of maintaining that social connection for the person with memory loss and their families. So many individuals coping with the dementia, we know they slowly isolate themselves from the community. Sometimes they may feel embarrassed that they're going to say the wrong thing or maybe do the wrong thing. So really we brought that concept from Europe here to the U.S. And in 2012, the very first memory cafes opened in Wisconsin.
Wow. Becky DeBurr is with us. She is a program director and outreach specialist for the Alzheimer's and Dementia Alliance of Wisconsin. Have you been to a memory cafe? Perhaps you've taken your aging parent or a relative to one. And if so, what was that experience like? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Becky, a memory cafe focused on arts related activities just is opening in Madison, about to open in Madison. What is that arts focus like?
Well, it's really interesting because we just had our first opening last Thursday, and they will continue to meet monthly. And so it's bringing in outside artists to help with that expression. So it could be music, it could be watercolor painting, it could be dance or yoga. And so just that opportunity for people who really connect in that way, that are looking for more specific activities to that, the arts, that's really the focus. And the person leading that is Noreen Crollup, who's based in our Madison office, and she has a long career of working with teaching artists, really, how to work with people who have memory loss. And so this is a passion of hers that we're so fortunate at the Alzheimer's Alliance that she has agreed to join our staff as our colleague and bring this really neat focus to the memory cafes.
As you've seen these memory cafes opening and building around the state, what has the reception been like to them?
The reception's been wonderful. At the Alzheimer's and Dementia Alliance, we really have a focus on rural communities. So we have outreach specialists in 15 counties, specifically speaking. And Dane County is the only really highly populated county of those 15. And so we're out in Grant County, Wisconsin, and Crawford County, and we're up in Sauk and Green Lake. And the turnout and the enthusiasm for memory cafes is wonderful. I think people are really looking for ways to after that diagnosis, how do I keep my loved one active? Where do I turn? What do I do? And so we try to be the answer to that, so that isolation and depression doesn't, become a focus for that specific household unit. And we're drawing people out, and it's really about creating friendships and having those just relationships where there's special meaning behind it. That's really where the Memory Cafe's focus is.
How have you seen loved ones, caregivers, impacted by Memory Cafe's?
Well, it's at the Alzheimer's and Dementia Alliance, our Memory Cafe facilitators go through a specific training, and so they're very knowledgeable about dementia and how it affects the person. But we're also really concerned about our care partners and how do we support them. So much of a Memory Cafe is modeling those interactions. We know that communication is one of the most stressful things with dementia, not only for the caregiver, but for the person with dementia. So oftentimes that word is right there on the tip of their tongue, but it just doesn't quite come. Or maybe they're, instead of saying the word, they're describing what it is they're trying to say. And so really the Memory Cafe gives folks the opportunity to see those interactions modeled. We always want to leave the silver lining or the feeling of hope, because the journey with dementia can be quite difficult and it can be long for care partners. So just that interaction and just feeling uplifted when you leave, that is really, really the focus for us.
We're talking about Memory Cafes with Becky DeBurr, started right here in Wisconsin. She is Program Director for the Alzheimer's and Dementia Alliance of Wisconsin. We're looking at how these cafes are a way for families to connect with others dealing with the same issues. Wisconsin has about 115,000 people living with dementia. According to the State Department of Health Services, that number of people with dementia is expected to rise dramatically as the population ages. What questions do you have about Memory Cafes? What do you think is the best way to support people with dementia? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. There's a line for you. We'll pick up the conversation in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. There are at least 20 Memory Cafes around the state now, and they're in a dozen counties. We're talking about these gatherings and how they help individuals and families cope with dementia and Alzheimer's. A memory cafe is a social gathering place for people with memory loss, mild cognitive impairment, early Alzheimer's, or other dementia, and their family and friends. Have you been to one? What was your experience like? What do you think is the best way to support people with Alzheimer's or dementia? Join in with your story at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We're talking with Becky DeBurr. She is our guide. She's program director and outreach specialist for the Alzheimer's and Dementia Alliance of Wisconsin. Becky, we talked a little bit about Madison's new memory cafe, but how have you seen it spread around the state, and what are some of the other themes?
Oh, well, there we in our Alzheimer's Alliance service delivery area, we have a memory cafe in nearly every county, I believe. I say nearly because we are currently going through a 5-county expansion right now, and so some of those are getting up and going shortly if they're not already happening. So the memory cafes do look different in the rural communities. They often are smaller in attendance, which, you know, we would expect. However, the benefits are still the same, where it's stimulating the mind, that opportunity to ask questions and get information in a safe environment, to be around people who understand, maybe offering a peer support as your relationship develops or friendships blossom. So it is, connecting to resources is a little different in the rural communities because we don't have as many resources as some of the bigger cities or towns may have. But we still have those avenues and those experts out in the rural communities that are always more than willing to help us build that dementia community and bring awareness to what's available for people on the dementia journey. And so spreading the word is really important, letting people know it's happening and really offering that open invitation. Anyone can come and partake. You don't have to have a diagnosis to come to one of our memory cafes. In general, if you identify as having some memory issues, that's okay, too. We're open and affirming to everyone.
If a community would like to get a memory cafe started, what is the avenue to getting one off the ground, getting one started?
Sure. Well, you can work through the Alzheimer's and Dementia Alliance. We offer our training to anyone who would like to do that. Oftentimes, we see small groups of volunteers come together and want to bring this to their community, and that is a very powerful thing. So we like to get together. We offer the training to everyone who's going to be involved, from the top all the way down to maybe someone who's going to take the phone calls. We want everyone to know and understand what a memory cafe is about. And so oftentimes they are volunteer-driven, and again, our information is open. Folks can contact us to get more information, to set them up. And then through the Alzheimer's and Dementia Alliance, we offer support. Once you are going as a memory cafe, we're there to offer resources and just support the facilitator as they move about. We also train the volunteers who want to be involved, because that's an important part of letting people know what's happening in your community, is the volunteers can speak to the memory cafe and have a good understanding about that, and so we offer that as well. So the memory cafes too, we do a lot of publicity, and so we look at what are the best ways to do that in your community, and what are the niche areas where people will hear about this. So every memory cafe is a little bit different because it's volunteer, it's driven by the participants and those that are helping facilitate it. So some can be more educational, some can be more social. Some are a combination of social and education. It just really depends on the participants.
Well, let's go to the phones now with Terry, who has dementia on her mind as she talks about dealing with a family member who had dementia. Terry, go ahead.
Yeah, I'd just like to say that I'm 57, UW alumni at the Dairy Science School here, and I've got knocked out 2 or 3 times, and I had a grandpa who had dementia bad, but he smoked heavy and whatnot continuously for a long time and drank. I quit drinking alcohol 3 years ago, and it's helped me immensely. I do believe my brain is getting better, but back to my dementia, it's it comes and goes. I'm eating healthy, trying to get vitamins. I often go to, maybe I shouldn't say this, the community pharmacy, kind of out my back door to the left.
Terry, where do you find support? Where is that social support network for you?
I think what I support the best is I know quite a few business owners. I've been around town for 33 years now. My son's 31, about 33 years. And I know a lot of business, August Store. Making new connections, I think, is very important.
So you continually try to reach out to others as you, you deal with your own dementia.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I went through PTSD from being a soldier in childhood, and I went through therapy for it. But the dementia thing, it's like you were saying earlier in your show as I was listening, it can be tricky, to say the least.
Well, Terry, thank you for the call. Becky, what strikes you there as Terry works through those memory loss issues?
Right. So for Terry, he did bring up a few things, and one would be, sounds like he has a military background, and so we're always trying to connect folks to resources in their community. And I would say to Terry that the VA has a very robust system in place for diagnosing dementias and support for the person and the care partner. And so I would encourage him to seek out what may be offered there, or to find an Alzheimer's support agency to help him take those next steps if he was looking to do that. And, of course, he talked about concussions, and so this is something that's been in the news a lot. And there's research surrounding this concussion syndrome, and as we learn more, I think we'll be able to speak more to that. But obviously that would be one to follow up with his primary care doctor on what could be the next steps that we could look into for that. But, you know, also the effect that alcohol can have on memory is, so if you are a person with memory loss and have a diagnosis and you are consuming alcohol, it is recommended to reduce that to the lowest level possible for you, just to make daily living more enjoyable, less confusion and things like that. So there's as Terry's situation, as he explained to us, it does get quite complicated. And where we can go with it is in the state of Wisconsin, we have the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute Network of Memory Diagnostic Clinics. And so those are really our experts in diagnosing and teasing out what may be happening here more extensively for Terry. And we always encourage families to seek out that resource and have that thorough testing done. Not everyone who goes to a memory diagnostic clinic is diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease or a similar dementia. Sometimes there's medication interactions. Sometimes there's other things going on. But having that in-depth look helps us figure that out for the patient. And at the geriatric assessment clinic where I meet along with the geriatrician and nurse practitioner with families, I've seen this many time and again. Also, depression plays quite an impact on memory loss, and so it's often, again, something we see and is treated once that is uncovered. So really wanting people to know that Wisconsin's very much on the cusp of innovation when it comes to supporting that diagnostic piece, but also care partners, because when you have the diagnosis, your pathway is narrowed to resources that are really going to help you now. And that's what the Alzheimer's and the Dementia Alliance focuses on, is how do we help people on the journey?
Yeah, because Alzheimer's and dementia are diseases with no cure, and patients and families really must find their own ways to manage the symptoms with their caregivers and their medical team. But outside of memory cafes, what other support is out there, activities available for this group of people?
Sure. There are education programs, and oftentimes we see that people do need to build their knowledge. Anytime you're entering any type of disease category, no matter what it is, understanding more about what's happening to your loved one or yourself is really powerful, and having that knowledge to move forward. It also helps to work alongside folks who've been there already, and maybe our support groups are a place where we have support groups for people with memory loss, but also for care partners. So we can talk about troubleshoot different situations. Oftentimes we learn the most from someone who's been through that before us, and so sharing of that information. There's other things like Meeting of Minds is a meditation relaxation type group for people with early stage memory loss, and so connecting to our thoughts and sometimes our emotions, because it's an emotional journey, and when we turn away from that, I think we're doing a little bit of a disservice, because when folks are heard and have the opportunity to share really what's on their mind, they can leave feeling better. And well, that's what it's all about.
Becky, thanks for joining us. Becky DeBurr is Program Director and Outreach Specialist for the Alzheimer's and Dementia Alliance of Wisconsin. Coming up next, the government shutdown has officially hit the one-month mark. We'll take a look here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We are 1 month and a day into the historical partial government shutdown. We see Senate Republicans who seem to be in lockstep, standing by President Trump's demand for $5.7 billion to build a border wall. But about 800,000 federal workers have been forced to go unpaid leave or work without pay since December 22nd, and there is mounting pressure. So where are you on this deadlock? How do you think the stalemate will end? Are you on furlough? Are you a federal worker who's been working without pay? How has this affected your life and your family's life? Has it put you behind on rent or your mortgage? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's bring in Laura Brown, who is watching this shutdown closely. She's an associate professor and director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University. Laura, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me on this morning.
So over the weekend, President Trump said he's willing to offer temporary protections for some undocumented immigrants in return for the $5.7 billion in funding for this border wall. What do we know about the specifics of this plan, this latest plan?
Well, what we know is that the Democrats have said this is certainly not sufficient in terms of a compromise or a proposal. This is really a discussion about President Trump reinstating a temporary protection that he had, in fact, repealed. So the Democrats do not see this as really moving the ball forward at all. You know, if he were perhaps going to be talking about permanent protections for the Dreamers and a path to citizenship, there might be some place to talk. But as of now, this proposal of the president's, while it is going forward into the Senate supposedly for a vote today, we don't imagine that Democrats are going to break away or support it.
So this was essentially a non-starter for Democrats.
Yes, it was absolutely. Most Democrats heard the specifics and said it was dead on arrival. I believe Speaker Pelosi had tweeted that what was new was not good, and that what was unoriginal was essentially, you know, the same as has always been. So she was much more thoughtful in her tweet than I was in describing it, but she did essentially immediately respond to the notion that this was just not a proposal that Democrats were enthusiastic about.
What is the tension like? I mean, you're there in Washington. What do you see around Capitol Hill and this tension between federal workers who are caught in the middle and then the politicians and the lawmakers on Capitol Hill?
Well, so many of the federal workers that are affected by this are all over the country. You know, we've seen many images of our TSA workers at the airports all over the country being expected to report and do their job even though they're not being paid. And in Washington, D.C. itself, you know, the streets are relatively quiet. There is not the usual traffic because those who are here and are furloughed are not essentially reporting to work. And then you have a sense of exasperation, I think, is the appropriate word among partisans on both sides of the aisle. Mostly just exasperation with the fact that this was assumed to be a decision that was decided before the holidays and even before the swearing in of the new Congress in January, and yet the president changed his mind after Rush Limbaugh and the conservative base suggested that he was selling out his border wall promise.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell had said that the Senate would, as you said, take up President Trump's immigration plan very soon. So what do you see happening with this legislation in the Senate? Will it go anywhere? And what role has Senator Mitch McConnell played in the shutdown and in the negotiations?
Well, I think this is what's so interesting is how much Senator Mitch McConnell has taken really a back seat to President Trump. He did, prior to the holiday break, bring bills forward that were essentially a continuing resolution on some of the departments, but it did also provide about $1.3 billion in border wall funding, really more border security issues than the wall itself. And that did pass the Senate. And then what we saw was President Trump say, I won't sign that bill, after McConnell had brought it to the floor and it had passed. And then we saw the then Speaker Ryan-led House essentially not move on those Senate proposals and instead put forward a different set of bills, which was the president's bill, which then never got taken up in the Senate. And now here we are, fast forward another month, and what we have is the House that is now being led by Speaker Nancy Pelosi having passed many of those same bills that had made it through the Senate before the holidays. They are awaiting Senate floor hearings. They are not going to get them because Mitch McConnell, the majority leader, has said, since President Trump won't sign them, I'm not bringing them forward.
Laura Brown is talking us through the politics of the partial government shutdown. She's an associate professor and director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University. You can join in this conversation at 800-642-1234. What is your situation like? Are you a federal worker who has been working without pay as a result of the shutdown? How has this impacted your life and your family's life? Are you upset that border security is the issue that's made this the longest government shutdown in history? Or do you think this is a worthy cause to fight for? How and when do you think the stalemate will end? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Laura, Bill from Green Lake emailed in to say, congressional Republicans need to stop being a doormat for the president and override a veto if necessary. As you look at both parties, how important is it that they, quote, win the shutdown, so to speak?
Well, I do think that one of the things your caller is bringing up is a really important point, and that is that the Congress is not supposed to just do the president's bidding. We have a system where we have a separation of powers and checks and balances. And what you would have expected in prior times that were not so dominated by the partisan polarization is that the Congress would have done its work. They would have found their own compromises and their own legislation that would have passed both chambers, and then they would have presented it to the president and said basically what the Congress can do to a president, take it or leave it, and then the president can either veto or sign. But there really has been a sense that the Republicans in Congress have been protecting this president from having to issue a veto.
Sounds like there is confusion on Capitol Hill, and there seems like the normal processes of legislation and how things move to the president is been upended, perhaps.
Well, I wouldn't say that it's confusion. What it really is about the fact that our two political parties now represent very diverse constituencies, and the majority of Republicans are in favor of building this border wall, and so those Republicans in Congress are adamant about standing by the president, even though they know that it is hurting them in some of the more moderate places, namely the suburbs, and some of those other independent Americans who are not so interested in this being the number one priority.
Laura Brown, how has public opinion played into this? What do the polls tell us?
Well, the polls do show that the two parties are about as far apart as you could possibly get. And we have a situation where Senator Mitch McConnell is running for re-election in Kentucky in 2020. And so as majority leader, someone who could try to fashion some sort of compromise, he is really standing behind President Trump because President Trump is much more popular in Kentucky than even he is.
Do you think that is essentially what is in the way of Republicans speaking out against the president? Is everyone in a Mitch McConnell situation here, or are there other reasons why we see Republicans in lockstep with the president?
Well, it really does have to do with the polarization in our parties. I mean, if you ask Americans, are you in favor of the border wall? The majority of Americans are actually not. But when you break out those sort of answers by political party, what you see is that the majority of Republicans are in favor of building this border wall. They're in favor of the president's proposal for $5.7 billion. The majority of Democrats are against it, and independents lean against it, but they are not sort of solidly or really in a large way against it. So what you have is a situation where the Republicans are playing to their base. The Democrats are certainly playing to their base, but the middle of the country, or those who identify as independent, are siding with the Democrats. So this is where it seems like the president and the Republicans are far outside the mainstream.
Talking with Laura Brown as our guide to the partial government shutdown, getting your thoughts as well at 800-642-1234. We'll get back to the conversation in a minute on the Ideas Network. You're with us on the morning show as we talk shutdown. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell plans to move ahead on President Trump's latest offer to Democrats. It calls for temporary protections for some immigrants in exchange for billions of dollars in wall money, as well as legislation to reopen the government. Nearly all Republicans have indicated they would back it. Congressional Democrats have rejected the proposal outright, have refused to negotiate with the president until the government is reopened. So what broader effect do you think the shutdown will have on the country? Do you think this could affect the level of confidence Americans have in our system of government? Do you worry about a ripple effect to the rest of the world? Call in at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Laura Brown stays with us. She directs the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University. Let's go to the phones now with Patricia joining us from Madison. Hi, Patricia.
Good morning. I have two comments. One of them, I think this federal layoff of the the employees would be settled soon if the cooks and cleaning personnel exited the White House. Secondly, we can't forget that Senator McConnell's wife, I think her name is Elaine Chao, is a cabinet member for Trump, and maybe he doesn't want to act against the president for fear that she will have to leave his cabinet.
Patricia, thanks for your call. Laura Brown, on that first note, what if the cooks and cleaning crew left the White House?
Well, actually, that is part of the reason why the president served fast food to the Clemson football team. Last week it was, when they were celebrating their national championship. Part of what is going on is that we do have funding for certain things, because this is a partial government shutdown. So not everything is closed, but it is impacting about 800,000 workers, about 400,000 of whom are furloughed, and another 400,000 are being asked to report to work without being paid. And obviously, we are approaching the end of another pay period, and it is true that the government would need to open by tonight if federal workers were to get their paychecks this week. So there is a great deal of pressure on the system, in the sense that federal workers are making their representatives well aware of the hardships they're enduring.
The president had implied that he might be willing to declare a national emergency in order to get funds for a border wall, especially if his latest proposal to Congress fails. So what does that scenario look like? What would a national emergency on the border actually mean?
Well, I think it would be very difficult for the president to argue that there is a national emergency. I mean, one of the things that is true is border crossings have dropped dramatically. We have seen the number of essentially individuals coming into the country illegally overall also dropping dramatically in the last decade. It's also the case that the president himself said that he would be declaring a national emergency if the Democrats basically don't agree to a deal. Well, that's not any sort of legal reason for a national emergency. So we imagine that were the president to try it very quickly, you would see this held up in a court of law.
And is that the possible consequences of taking this path, is that it would be subject to litigation?
Yes, and I think that's why the president has not pursued it. I mean, I think it was simply a threat, but it was, in his mind at least, something that was legitimate that he could, in fact, do. Many Republicans are against it. I think, as Senator Marco Rubio even mentioned, you know, Republicans, you should really think about this, because what if there were a Democratic president in the next administration who decided to declare climate change a national emergency? So this is one of those situations where where both parties are very well aware of the precedents they set.
Let's bring in another call. Let's go to Patrick, joining us from Richland County. Patrick, hi.
Hey, good morning. Great show. I have a question for your guest, and this is simply, the wall is foolish. Just about everybody knows that. So to control immigration, these people are coming in for jobs because there's nothing where they're coming from. It's been destroyed because of, well, sometimes U.S. policy. But anyway, why not have it so that if you're an employer, creator, as the Republicans were calling them a while ago, and you get caught employing people without the proper paperwork for citizenship, then the employer's in quite a bit of trouble. And why isn't that seriously looked at? I mean, the state paper a while ago had a major story about the farmers saying, hey, what are we going to do if our illegal help isn't able to help us out anymore? So what's up with that? And thank you so much for this show.
So what about putting more of a burden on employers to ensure they have their paperwork together?
Well, what's actually sort of ironic and tragic about this shutdown is, in fact, the verification system by which employers verify the legality of their employees right now is also sort of operating at the most minimal level or almost shut down because there are not employees there to work with those employers who need to verify their employees'
You're talking
status.
About E-Verify?
That's correct. So it is a really fascinating situation in that this shutdown is, in fact, making our border security worse at the moment because, obviously, our Border Patrol agents, many of them are working without pay. There are these other systems that are delayed or not fully operational. That being said, it is important to also realize that many of the immigrants who are here illegally have simply overstayed their visas. So part of the reason why when you start talking about border security, really border security means making sure that we have an understanding of where people are in the country who have come to this country as either a visitor or a temporary worker. And that's part of the reason why technology plays such a role. And yes, it's true that cracking down on employers who hire immigrants who do not have the appropriate documentation is something that is important to be done. Part of the problem, though, is so much of that happens at the small business level, and it happens through a cash economy, and it happens in a way in which no one is really fully tracking it.
So, Laura, we've talked about the forces driving the president. We've looked at why Republicans and Democrats can't get together on this issue and figure out how to deal with the shutdown. How much longer do you think this impasse could last?
Sadly, I don't know that anyone knows. I hesitate at this point to even speculate. I had thought that we would be out of this a long time ago, but it does appear as though Senate Republicans are sticking with the president, and it certainly Democrats have every reason to stand by Speaker Pelosi given the last election's results. So we are in very much a gridlock situation and a stalemate.
And as we just a few seconds left here, any scenario that would look plausible here to get us out of this, any type of scenario?
Well, I agree with your caller. I actually think the Congress should do its work and they should test whether or not there is a veto and the potentiality of a veto override. In other words, I think that our process is much better than our people in it, and I think that our representatives should abide by the process and not just their partisanship.
Laura, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Laura Brown is an associate professor and director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us for The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.